I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush has had an unexpected change of diplomatic schedule. He was due to meet with King Abdullah of Jordan tomorrow, but at the last moment, Jordan's monarch, one of America's closest allies in the Middle East, canceled the meeting. The cancellation is seen as a way of showing Jordan's displeasure with the White House decision to back Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan for a complete withdrawal from Gaza and for Israel's territorial claims in the West Bank, and with President Bush's statement rejecting the Palestinians' historic claims on lands left behind in 1948. We spoke a short while ago with Labib Kamhawi in the Jordanian capital, Amman. He is a political commentator on Arab affairs, and I began by asking him whether it had been expected that King Abdullah would call off tomorrow's meeting.
Not really, because the developments were sudden. The fact that Mr. Bush decided to declare a serious change in the U.S. position vis-a-vis some very, very important and sensitive issues like the right of return for the Palestinians and the settlement issue was an embarrassment for the king, who was shocked with these declarations just a few days before his scheduled meeting with the president.
So it was a total surprise to King Abdullah that this change in U.S. policy was about to happen.
I think so, because otherwise he would have simply delayed his visit, because the king cannot meet Mr. Bush and return back home without having a concession, a public concession, retraction from this declared position on these two issues. That would be a serious blow to the prestige and credibility of the king, and would jeopardize his position inside his own country and in the region as well.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit further. How serious, how difficult is King Abdullah's position at the moment, just inside Jordan with his own people?
Well, now you know that more than 50% of the Jordanian population is of Palestinian descent, not to mention the geographic proximity that links Jordan to the Palestinian territories on the one side and Iraq on the other side. So Jordan is strategically sandwiched between two very volatile countries.
As an example of the dangers faced by Jordanian society being between Israel and the Palestinians and Iraq on the other side, police in Amman today were involved in a gun battle, killing three suspected terrorists who were alleged to have been planning to detonate a very large bomb in Amman.
Well, I think the battle is still going on, and there is some talk about these guys being Iraqis. But irrespective of the nationality of these guys, I mean, if the situation in Iraq is not stable, then Jordan is not stable too, because people will come to Jordan and try to do in Jordan what they failed to do in Iraq, for example. Or they like to expand the battle beyond the Iraqi borders to cover more countries just to force the U.S. to stretch thin in the region instead of concentrating its military might inside Iraq itself. The fact is you cannot dissociate this from the feeling of the people of Jordan themselves on these issues related to Iraq and Palestine. People feel very strongly about the situation in Iraq and Palestine, and they are not really in harmony with the position of the government, which is rather soft in handling especially the Iraqi issue and the occupation of Iraq. So, I mean, the whole thing is triggering instability inside Jordan itself and in other countries in the region.
Labib Kamhawi, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Labib Kamhawi is a commentator on Arab affairs for Al Hayat newspaper and Al Quds Al Arabi in London. He joined us on a line from Amman, Jordan.
Israeli Finance Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced that Israel will invest tens of millions of dollars in West Bank settlements, even as it leaves the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu also expressed support for the new Middle East plan, which was outlined by Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush last week, and will be voted on by Sharon's Likud party in May. Joining us on the line from Tel Aviv is Charles Radin of the Boston Globe. Hello, Charlie.
Hi.
Well, let's hear your opinion on the significance of Netanyahu's remarks. First, to the plan. What is the significance to the settlements in the West Bank themselves that Israel isn't planning on investing money into them?
Well, they've been investing money into them right along. The Israelis do not make a distinction between citizens of Israel and citizens of the territories, except to the extent that sometimes the policies even have favored the development of the territories over development in Israel proper,
if you will.
But that's, of course, it opens the whole argument about what is Israel proper.
Hmm. Does this, for Palestinians, though, does this is this further hardening of the facts on the ground? In other words, the more investments there are in these West Bank settlements, the less likely Palestinians are to have this as part of their future independent state, which, of course, they want.
That's exactly what it is. And he and Sharon are saying to the people in these big settlements, it's for real. You know, we're going to strengthen these settlements. And so it confirms to the Palestinians what it is they face.
What is the significance of Benjamin Netanyahu now, former prime minister, now finance minister?
Well, I think the whole group of things that have happened since he became finance minister have really tremendously rebuilt him and made him the presumptive successor to Ariel Sharon as prime minister of Israel, you know, much more than would have been the case when he came in as finance minister. Before this very critical endorsement of Sharon's redeployment in Gaza plan came up, Netanyahu went through months and months of very, very tough financial reforms. And I think that he, in this way, started to repair himself with people who thought he was a slick politician and a media man. He took on a really thankless job that needed to be done, and it has started to show some results in terms of economic revival here.
Mm. Does Netanyahu's backing of Ariel Sharon's plan ensure the May 2nd vote, the referendum on the Gaza withdrawal, does it ensure that it's a certainty?
I think so. I mean, nothing's a certainty till it happens, but it would be flabbergasting because whatever of the center of control of Likud is not controlled by Sharon is controlled by Netanyahu.
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and President George Bush both used the word withdrawal when talking about leaving Gaza. Many, including your colleague at the Boston Globe, Tom Oliphant, write that that's really a fiction, that Israel isn't really withdrawing from Gaza, that in fact they'll still be in control of the water and all the utilities. Your take on that, is this really going to be a withdrawal from the Gaza Strip?
It's more of a redeployment, I would say, than it is a withdrawal. And I wouldn't say the Israelis have too much pictured it in Israel as anything other than that. They dressed it up when he was in the States. Until the Palestinians, this is the Israeli leaders talking, until the Palestinian leaders show that they're going to get control of the terrorists, the Israelis are not really giving them more than a centimeter at a time. And they're very blunt-spoken that they don't intend to. So, yeah, redeployment of forces is a better way to put it than withdrawal. You know, they'll put forces near the Gaza Strip but outside it. You wouldn't call that an end to occupation.
Charlie Radin, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin, as always.
Reporter Charles Radin of the Boston Globe, he spoke to us from Tel Aviv.
Bob Woodward's new book, Plan of Attack, is turning into a rather large boulder thrown into the Washington pond. Among the ripples created by the book is a claim that the Bush administration had begun diverting funds towards war preparations in the Gulf in July 2002, before Congress had authorized the use of force in Iraq. That authorization came in a vote in October of 2002, a point Woodward underscored in an interview on 60 Minutes last Sunday.
Gets to a point where in July, the end of July 2002, they need $700 million, and the president approves it, but Congress doesn't know, and it is done. They get the money from a supplemental appropriation for the Afghan war.
Joining us on the line is former presidential candidate and former senator from Florida, Bob Graham, who's campaigning with John Kerry in Florida today. Welcome, Senator Graham.
Thank you, Michael.
Now, Senator Graham, you were chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee when all this was happening. Were you aware of this diversion of funds?
I was not aware of the specific diversion of funds. I was very aware that the Bush administration was starting to prepare for war in Iraq, and it wasn't in the summer of 2002. It was in the winter of 2002. I'm talking to you from Tampa, which is the headquarters of Central Command. I visit that command on a regular basis to get briefings. And in February of 2002, I had a briefing on the status of the war in Afghanistan, after which one of the commanding officers at Central Command told me, Senator, what is happening is that significant amounts of the military personnel and equipment and intelligence capabilities are being moved out of Afghanistan to get ready for the war in Iraq. So it was a full 6 months prior to the diversion of the $700 million that the administration was underway getting ready for a war in Iraq.
But in a situation like this, would you, as chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, expect to be briefed that, you know, we're going to fund this, pay for this activity in a certain way?
Yes, in terms of those activities which were going to be conducted in a clandestine manner, which would have particularly related to the intelligence upon which the war was predicated. The normal procedure is if funds that have been appropriated for one purpose are going to be diverted to another, the administration would talk to the appropriations committees in the House and the Senate and get their approval for a redirection of those funds.
So, but to your knowledge, did this happen at any time, say, You reference the winter of 2002. The vote authorizing the use of force in Iraq was October 2002. So in the previous 10 months, were these kinds of briefings held? I mean, did congressional leaders know that funds were being diverted for this buildup to war?
Apparently not. I know we were not briefed on the Intelligence Committee, and from what I gather, comments of other members of Congress, they were not briefed.
Do you consider that improper?
Yes, I think it's improper. The administration continues to want to call the war in Iraq a part of the war on terrorism.
One final question. If this money was diverted from a supplemental authorization by Congress of, say, $700 million earmarked for Afghanistan, if this money was then diverted for Iraq, what would you say about that in terms of how things are settling in Afghanistan at the moment?
I would say we've paid a high price for failing to complete the war against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Senator Graham, thank you very much for joining us.
Good. Thank you very much.
Bob Graham is former presidential candidate and former senator from Florida. He spoke with us from Tampa, where he's campaigning today with Democratic presidential nominee presumptive John Kerry.
Just ahead. Antibiotic-resistant bacteria finding a home in industrial chicken coops.
And later, the golden era of country music captured on film.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Industrial chicken barns harbor a previously unsuspected stew of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The finding, published yesterday in the journal Proceedings of the American Academy of Sciences, may have implications for agriculture and people. We're joined by the author of the new study, Ann Summers, a University of Georgia microbiologist. Welcome, Professor Summers.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, you looked at something called chicken litter. What exactly is that, and what did you find?
Well, chicken litter is a substance that's on the floor of chicken houses. And it starts out as wood shavings, and it ends up with whatever else is dropped in there during the course of about 6 week period when the chickens grow from being little hatchlings to being what we call broilers.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff in there. We should be
right.
Clear. There's feathers and insects and, of course, feces.
Right, right.
And what did you find in the litter?
Well, what we found in the litter was a surprising abundance of a certain gene. And the gene or gene system is called an integron, and it is capable of assembling multiple resistances to antibiotics. And the abundance of it was surprising. The integron was well known and well studied in individual bacteria from hospitals, but we went out to look, and it's in the bacteria in the chicken litter.
And what does it say to you that there are so many of these integrons?
Well, the surprising thing about this are twofold. One is that they've largely been studied in E. coli-type bacteria, but the fact that we found so many of them, and we found them in bacteria that are unrelated to E. coli, suggests that they are really more peripatetic than we had imagined, that they actually can move around more widely in the bacteria than we'd ever realized. And this fact means that an antibiotic resistance that gets picked up or collected by an integron might be shared and exchanged and spread throughout bacterial communities much more rapidly than we had appreciated before.
Right.
That's a possibility. I mean, that hasn't actually been addressed, but there's been a long-standing puzzle about how these things spread so fast. And it looks like part of the reason is that there's just a lot more spreaders out there.
Right. I mean, I'm trying to think through one of the implications. For instance, it was often thought that there was certain bacteria that was resistant to some antibiotic, you could surely find another antibiotic to treat that. But you're saying that bacteria might swap out with another integron, making it further resistant to antibiotics.
Oh, yeah. The issue of single antibiotic resistance was, that's an old-time thing. That's 40 years ago when we had single antibiotic resistances cropping up. Indeed, you're right that you can always find another drug that you could treat with. But over the last 20 or 30 years, really, bugs have been coming up with multiple resistance genes.
And now you're finding that this integron, this antibiotic-resistant gene, is disseminated a lot more than you thought.
All right, let's back up a little bit further. And it's not just an antibiotic resistance gene. It's a collector of antibiotic resistance genes. Okay, so it's clusters antibiotic resistance genes together and moves them around together.
Well, what would a recommendation be? I mean, should farmers stop giving antibiotics to chickens?
I think that probably wouldn't work very well. You know, if animals on a farm get sick, you have to treat them.
Well, of course, organic farmers don't give antibiotics to their chickens.
I know that's the case. And organic farmers typically work on a much smaller scale.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of antibiotics for protecting chickens' health is more a need in the large industrial farms that supply most of the meat that we use in this country.
Mm.
If you want to stop doing that, then perhaps it might be the case that you could get along without the use of any antibiotics, but it would make a big dent in our access to animal protein.
So in the meantime, what is the message to farmers that use antibiotics?
Well, the message to farmers to minimize and judiciously use antibiotics in whatever you do, and the same thing goes for antibiotics that are used in humans.
Well, I'm wondering, back to the chicken litter, though, could another consideration be that this chicken litter is also fed to cattle in beef feedlots, which furthers the integrons down the food chain?
Sure. I don't know the details of that. It is typical to have this material be aged and dried before it's passed along, and the possible viability of the bacteria in this context remains to be examined. But it's a formal possibility, and I think it's certainly one that's worth examining.
How does the fact that they are in such preponderance in chicken litter affect people?
Well, I think it's an interesting model system for something that we should and will look at in humans. We're actually looking at some strains right now that we got from colleagues at CDC to examine this very question.
I read that this antibiotic-resistant cluster, if you will, can exist, let's say, in my dog. Let's say my dog has taken tons of antibiotics, and I don't take any antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that this can move from my dog to me?
It's a formal possibility. In fact, there's a phenomenon for which we have very few actual measurements. But a colleague of mine at the vet school here, Susan Sanchez, has been doing some work on this and has found that strains of benign bacteria, including antibiotic-resistant strains of benign bacteria, are in fact shared between pets and their owners.
Hmm. So in essence, I might find myself resistant to an antibiotic, even though I hadn't taken too many antibiotics, because of something I'd picked up from my dog.
Well, yeah, and it wouldn't be you that's resistant. It'd be your bacterial
right.
community that's resistant
right.
because it's not people who become resistant. It's their bacteria. And so, yeah, it's entirely possible that depending upon what your dog was taking, that you might transiently carry a bug that you got from your dog. If your dog likes to lick your face or lick your hands or something like that, hey, that's going to happen. That, you know, the other parts of the dog licks, you wouldn't lick, but hey, you know, it's going to end up on your face.
I guess the surprising part, I mean, we assume that we'll share bugs, but the surprising part is that we'll share resistance to antibiotics.
It's in bugs.
There you go. Professor, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Ann Summers, professor at the University of Georgia. Her study appears in the current issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, there are diehard Republicans and diehard Democrats, and somewhere in the middle, committed centrists. We look at attempts by politicians to appeal to this important segment of the voting population.
And the music of the French techno duo Air. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The Supreme Court heard arguments today about the more than 600 foreign-born prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Some of the men have been held for more than 2 years without access to legal representation. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is Tony Morrow. He covers the Supreme Court for American Lawyer magazine and the Legal Times. He sat in on this morning's hearings. He's just emerged from the courtroom. Tony, tell us briefly, what is the Bush administration arguing in this case?
Well, the administration claims that even though these detainees are basically imprisoned by the United States, that they really don't have any access to the writ of habeas corpus, which is the right to challenge one's imprisonment, because they are primarily because they're in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which the government claims is outside the jurisdiction of the United States, but also because the Bush administration has determined that they are enemy combatants and not entitled to any kind of judicial review.
In other words, they're not soldiers, they're not prisoners of war as such. But what are critics saying?
Well, the critics are saying, for one thing, that that Guantanamo Bay is effectively under the United States control. It has been since 1903. The lawyer for the detainees said that if you send a letter from Guantanamo Bay with a stamp that has Fidel Castro on it, it won't leave the base, implying that the U.S. has a tremendous power over what goes on in Guantanamo Bay, and it may as well be part of the United States. So if that's the case, this advocate felt that these detainees should have access to United States courts, just like any citizen in the United States.
Well, Tony, in fact, if you could clarify something, is this debate just about whether or not Guantanamo Bay is foreign soil, or does it apply to foreign citizens being held by the U.S. on other foreign soils, for instance, Iraq or Afghanistan?
Well, the focus at the arguments today really was Guantanamo Bay. It is kind of unique. I don't think anybody would argue that somebody, in fact, this was asked, and the advocate for the detainees said that he would not argue that somebody who is detained on the battlefield would have the right to have a judge review his case. There is a recognition that a battlefield is different from a place like Guantanamo, which is thousands of miles away from the battlefield.
And Tony, just the minute we have left, we wonder your sense of how it's going. And we know that Solicitor General Ted Olson is arguing for the government. His wife, we remind people, died on one of the airplanes on 9/11. He came out of the court and said, "This nation is at war." Is that resonating?
I think it is. The Supreme Court is—they are very conscious of civil liberties, but they're also very conscious that it's the executive branch's job to conduct war. So I think my sense from the argument was that they will be deferential to the government, in at least some respect, support their view that these detainees do not have the right to of access to U.S. courts.
And just a couple seconds left. Something else that struck you from this morning?
Well. It was quite an exciting day. There were a big crowd, and there are more cases coming next week on similar issues. This is the first wave of cases emanating from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, Tony, hopefully we can talk to you again. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Tony Morrow covers the Supreme Court for American Lawyer magazine and the Legal Times. He sat on this morning's Supreme Court hearings on the legality of foreign prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay.
When Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan speaks, people listen. And not just because he's sometimes difficult to understand. Everyone from bankers to homebuyers are wondering if he'll allude to the possibility of raising interest rates when he speaks before the Senate Banking Committee later today. Joining us on the line is Darcy Bradbury, Managing Director of the investment firm Meza Kappa Management, based in New York City. Now, Darcy, when you talk interest rates in an election year, there's always a political dimension, and we'll come to that in a minute. But what is the economic situation that would lead one to think we might be in for a rise in interest rates?
Well, as you know, since the recession in 2001, we have been gradually recovering as a country in terms of companies' performance. Even employment has begun to turn the corner and start to increase. More importantly, we've probably seen inflation rear its head again after being pretty low for a few years now. And so those things all point to longer-term increases in interest rates.
A rise in interest rates dealing with inflation. How does that settle inflation?
Well, low interest rates, particularly the low short-term interest rates that the Federal Reserve Bank controls directly, tend to stimulate the economy. And that's what the Federal Reserve has been trying to do. The sort of interest rate environment that they've created the last couple of years is pretty unusual. The 1% Federal Reserve rate that they've been holding on to hasn't been seen since the 1950s. So they've been working pretty hard to get the economy going.
So now let's come to the politics of all of this. It's 2004. There is an election campaign well underway. The Federal Reserve Chairman is meant to be above partisan politics. But really, in choosing when to raise rates, if we assume that it's a likelihood at this moment with the economy beginning to warm up significantly, when is this likely to happen?
Well, I would handicap it either by June or after November, because I think the Federal Reserve does not like to be in the harsh spotlight. They do not want to be held responsible for the outcome of the election. And so I would guess they either want to do it sooner, before the conventions and all the speeches and the heavy-duty campaigning, or they're going to wait until after the election.
If you say June, if it's going to happen before the election, it would have to go in one big jump, I mean, or two smaller ones, say a jump in May and then a jump in June?
Well, the funny thing about the Federal Reserve is that they have two tools. They have raising interest rates, but they also have the power of their words. They're sort of like the oracles of Delphi for our new economy.
Well, certainly Alan Greenspan is an oracle of Delphi.
His words portend the future of the economy to a lot of investors and other people. In 1994, when the last time they did a big turn like this, the very first increase in short-term rates, which was quite modest, had a huge impact on long-term interest rates because investors are smart enough to know this wouldn't be the last increase. And so they can jump rather quickly to the conclusion. The problem that that can cause in the short term is a lot of market disruption. And in fact, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, has put out a report warning the U.S. that if it doesn't start to raise short-term interest rates soon, it's tempting fate, and you could have this kind of economic disruption because of a more severe reaction.
Darcy Bradbury, thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
Darcy Bradbury is a managing director of the investment firm Mezzacapa Management, based in New York City.
Still to come, the work of Henry Hornstein. A teacher told him to photograph what he liked, so he turned his lens on Nashville.
You're listening to Here and Now. In the year 2000, Illinois Governor George Ryan suspended executions in his state because new research had been used to exonerate several men on death row. A new study of exoneration by researchers at the University of Michigan suggests that there may be even more innocent people serving hard time than had been previously suspected. They number possibly in the thousands. Joining us on the line from Ann Arbor is the study's lead author, Samuel Gross. He's professor of law at the University of Michigan. And Professor, in your study, you looked at cases from 1989 forward. Why start in 1989?
1989 is the year in which the first DNA exonerations in the United States occurred. And that began something of a revolution, first in the detection of false convictions, and more generally in our understanding of the fallibility of our criminal justice system in general.
What is the main reason for wrongful convictions?
For rape cases, which are the cases that DNA is useful for, the major cause of errors is misidentifications. In murder cases, the major causes of error are perjury and false confessions.
You were looking at exonerations, and many of them were in the heaviest violent crimes, murder and rape. Why is that?
Almost all of them were in murder and rape. And there are two reasons. For rape, it's because of the development of DNA technology. So before 1989, the most common crime for which errors would later be discovered, and not nearly as many, was robbery. After that, all of a sudden, we were able to detect with certainty misidentifications in rape cases, and the number of rape exonerations skyrocketed, and the number of robbery exonerations stayed behind. In murder cases, the reason why they're so common appears to be that we devote much more attention to reinvestigating and examining murder cases after conviction and are more likely to discover the errors that occur in those cases.
You extrapolate from your study that there are perhaps tens of thousands of people wrongfully convicted serving time in America's jails. How do you make the leap from the 300-plus cases you looked at in particularly vicious crimes to this much larger figure?
There's every reason to believe that there are more errors in robbery cases than rape cases. They're both crimes of violence that are sometimes committed by strangers, but robberies are more often committed by strangers than rapes, and robbery convictions are more common than rape convictions, and robberies are more frequently interracial, and the biggest danger of misidentification is in interracial crimes. The other thing to look at is the death row cases. A quarter of 1% of American prisoners are on death row, but they account for 22% of all the exonerations that have occurred in the past 15 years. And there are only two possible explanations. One is that there are the same proportion of errors in non-death sentence cases, but that we haven't discovered that. The other possibility is that we are much more likely to make mistakes and convict the wrong person in a death sentence case than in another case. Given the magnitude of the difference, between the exoneration rate for death penalty cases and other crimes, the truth has to be a combination of these two terrible possibilities.
Professor Samuel Gross, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Samuel Gross is professor of law at the University of Michigan. He spoke to us on the line from Ann Arbor.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When Henry Horenstein first decided to become a photographer in the late 1960s, he looked to his professor for guidance. Shoot what you like was what he heard. So Horenstein started photographing his lifelong passion, country music. Henry Horenstein didn't set out to document what many call the last great era in country music, but that's just what he did. From 1972 to 1981, he hung out backstage at the Grand Ole Opry, spent hours in legendary Nashville honky-tonks, shot publicity photos for the country bluegrass label Rounder Records, and traveled to the country music parks that were popular at the time. He and his camera captured rising stars, established musicians, and the fans who loved them both. A new book and photo exhibit at Boston University feature his work from that period. Here now is Andrea Shea toured the gallery with now well-known photographer and historian Henry Horenstein, who explained one of the many differences between country music stars then and now.
Today, a lot of the musicians come right out of the box. They're young, they're talented, they're good-looking, so they video well. But in those days, I mean, we're looking at a picture of Dolly Parton now, for example, I took in 1972. She was at the time with the Porter Wagoner Band, and Porter Wagoner was a big star, still around, still plays the Grand Ole Opry. And Dolly was his girl singer, basically. He had a bunch of them over the years, and she was with him for about 4 years when I took this picture. They were coming to Boston to Symphony Hall, and she'd had three or four hit songs, but she wasn't on her own yet. She was still part of the Porter Wagoner show.
How old is she in the shot?
She was 26.
There's a picture that I carry. One we made some time ago.
So you eventually ended up going down to Nashville and getting backstage passes to the Grand Ole Opry. Maybe we can see some pictures from that.
Oh, sure, yeah. In fact, in those days, it was pretty easy to get back there. And once you were back there, people just took you in. And I was interested in the stars, the Dolly Partons and the Minnie Pearls, you know, people like that, and I definitely photographed them. But I was even more interested in the people who went to the country music shows. Now, this is a picture of two women waiting backstage at the Grand Ole Opry, and I showed the picture to Eddie Stubbs, who wrote the foreword of the book. Eddie's one of the announcers on the Grand Ole Opry and a wonderful fiddler, and I asked him if he knew who these women were, because he knows everybody in Nashville, and he said, I don't know, but they looked like two pissed-off wives to me. They might have been musicians' wives, I don't know.
And all the pictures are in black and white. Mm-hmm. And who's this, Minnie Pearl?
Yeah, Minnie Pearl and Pee Wee King. You know, this is part of, to me, being a photographer, studying history. Now, Minnie Pearl's fairly well known, and Pee Wee King, certainly in the world of country music and the music world. Pee Wee King wrote a song called Tennessee Waltz, which was one of the most recorded songs of all time. Patti Page had a hit on it in the 50s. So people knew these people, but they were really country acts. They were not acts that crossed over into a general audience.
Yes, I lost my little darling the night they were playing the beautiful Tennessee Waltz.
Just the style of the photographs, they're quite straight on. You know, the subjects are in the center of the frame. It has kind of a Diane Arbus quality to it almost. Was this conscious on your part?
Oh, very much so. Diane Arbus was a huge star, you know, when I was coming up, when I was a young photographer.
And why did you take this approach?
Well, I liked the fact that it wasn't artful. You know, I didn't really have an art training. I had a historian's training, and my idea as a historian really ought to really show the information, you know, tell the story in as objective a way as possible. And that's what I was trying to do in this style. I'm not getting really close up and showing details. I'm showing the person and what's around the person, and then letting the whole thing tell the story. I'm printing it in a very neutral way. There's no attitude to the printing so much there, just there.
And one of the differences with these pictures compared to pictures we might see today of different performers or famous people of any kind, but especially musicians, is the access, or even the access time you had to them.
A big, 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 big difference. I was at the Grand Ole Opry in the fall, and I just felt like any time I picked up my camera that there were three people about to tell me I couldn't do this or I should do that. And this was very, I say it's real, you know, real in the sense that no one was telling me what to do, even with Rounder Records. They kind of just told me to get a picture. The most art-directed picture here was the picture of Jerry Lee Lewis, which was art-directed by him. Here he is at his piano in the penthouse of the Ramada Inn, which is the fourth floor of the Ramada Inn near Logan Airport. And, you know, he posed for me. He said, take one like this. He didn't, like, force me or anything, but he was helping me, really. And it's one of my favorite pictures here. It's Jerry Lee lighting a cigar and looking cocky and young and good. And he set up that picture, really. I just executed it. You believe me.
Reckless. Oh, Ralph
Stanley, this picture here might be interesting to you. I photographed him at his home in Coburn, Virginia. And this is a guy who had a great career and, you know, just an amazing repertoire of songs. And when Brother, Where Art Thou came out, when that film came out, he had a song on there called Oh Death. It won a Grammy, and Ralph never, as far as I know, had a hit song before. The guy next to him, Curly Ray Klein, died a few years ago, and he was the backbone of Ralph's band for so many years. And in a way, I like having this picture better because he's a guy who's forgotten.
I'm riding on that midnight train, my head hanging low. These all the blues left by me, forever by me.
You must have been like a kid in a candy shop, being inside these people's homes. These are your favorite musicians.
Well, I yes, that's true. I was, but I also was nervous as hell because I didn't really know what I was doing. I was really just starting out, and I was nervous every time I was photographing any of these musicians because I kind of kept running out, kind of. I was afraid they'd kick me out or something, you know. So I really like these honky-tonk pictures. I was more comfortable in those pictures anyway because people were just kind of hanging around, and I didn't really have to work with anyone specifically.
Another place where country music was really thriving was at these music parks.
Yeah. Every state had a few of them. Massachusetts still has one left called the Indian Ranch. But these musicians would come up from the Opry and they would tour out into, you know, these parks.
So the picture we're looking at here, it's in the book, is Tommy Cash, Johnny Cash's brother, signing autographs?
Yeah, Tommy Cash had a career for a while as a country singer. He may still be working, I'm not sure. But he had some hit songs in the 70s, and he played out in these places. And so the connection with the fans, which modern musicians for the most part really don't have.
Some people stick pretty close to home. Others are born with the urge to roam. Welcome, welcome to our town. I hope nobody tries to gun you down. Goodbye, Bobby.
Tell me about these two pictures. It's Bill Monroe and his brother Charlie.
Well, Bill Monroe was a very, very well-known musician, and he's widely credited with starting bluegrass music, his band, the Bluegrass Boys. The music was really invented in the late 30s and early 40s by Charlie and Bill Monroe, and popularized more by Bill. And you can see here that he's got a lot of pride, he's very well-dressed, and he takes his glasses off for the picture.
The lonesome side of a train going by makes me want to stop and cry.
And Charlie had a career, and a good career for a while after he and Bill split up. They started out as the Monroe Brothers in the late 30s, and he was in not good circumstances, as I understand it, through the 60s and wasn't playing music at all. And then in the early 1970s, bluegrass festivals came back. They got him to play a few festivals. In his last few years of his life, he did start playing and was seen again. But this is a good example of what I was trying to get when I was taking the pictures. I really wanted a picture of Charlie Monroe or people like him because they were so important at their time, and they have, in their way, disappeared. And in a small way, I feel like I've preserved them.
Brother.
Photographer, educator, and author Henry Hornstein speaking with Here and Now's Andrea Shea about his book and exhibit, Honky Tonk, Portraits of Country Music, 1972-81. For more and to see pictures, go to our website, here-now.org.
Does it hold you away? Whoa.
what would you give?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
In exchange, what would you give? In exchange, what would you give? In exchange for your soul. Oh, if today.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.